Advent is a season that the church has practiced for thousands of years, where the church retells and remembers the story of Jesus' birth at Christmas. But we got to be really careful in how we approach this season, and why would the church do this? Advent is not a word that the Bible invented. Advent is just a word that was taken from the ancient world, which just means the appearing, the arrival. When someone very important, a king, an emperor, a dignitary, someone was coming to your town or your village and you got word of it and the messengers told you, hey, the king's coming, the ruler's coming, this very important person is coming. You didn't know when they were coming, but you prepared for their arrival, for their advent. When is the king going to advent among us? When is he going to arrive? And we're anticipating, we're eager, and we want it to happen, but we don't know when. And so rightfully, historians and theologians have said, hey, Christmas is an advent. It was the arrival of Jesus, someone very important, and no one knew exactly when it would happen. And the prophets foretold it, but they didn't know. The people of God didn't know. We'll talk about that a little bit today. But here's why we remember that story. We remember the first advent of Jesus, but we don't just remember the first advent, the first coming, the first appearing of Jesus to be sentimental. We don't just remember the first coming of Jesus for nostalgia's sake, although I love nostalgia. But we don't just remember the retelling or the story of Christmas for the decorations, although I love Christmas decorations. You maybe would have thought differently yesterday if you'd watched me try to put up mine. But I do love that. Like, I love it. But we don't just do it to look back and go, oh, what a sweet story. We remember the first advent of Jesus. We retell the first advent of Jesus because in this season for the church that we're in, that we have been in, we're waiting on his second advent. That's actually all of our hope. We're waiting. We're in the darkness of, Lord, when you said you would come again. You said you would arrive again. You said you would come and make all things new. You said you would come and heal the world. You said you would restore what's been lost. When are you going to do it? We're waiting on the second advent. And it feels like crazy making in a world that shows no signs of Jesus showing up anytime soon. And so when is he going to advent? When is he going to come? When is he going to arrive? Man, it would be easy not to believe that he's not going to come again. And so we retell the first advent story to give us courage to dare to hope, oh, he really is going to come again. And how do we know that? Because he came once and he told us he was coming again. So we retell the story to give us hope for his second coming and all of the remembering of the beauty of the story that happened 2,000 years ago outside Bethlehem. So that's the big Advent intro. And how we're going to do that this year, sometimes we look at shepherds and angels and we'll read some of those passages. And sometimes we look at Mary and Joseph and wise men, and that's all in there. But this year we're actually going to go into the Old Testament. If you were with us this fall, we studied the book of Judges, which is this chaotic plane crash of a book where Israel's rebelling and everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes, and it's a train wreck plane crash of a book. And that book ends in darkness, and then you flip the page, and the very next sentence after Judges ends is the book of Ruth, Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, in the days the judges ruled. So it's telling you something. Reader, hey, while this plane crash was going on for the book of Judges, there was another storyline being written that you didn't know about. There was another storyline being written of light bursting into the darkness through this woman named Ruth and what happened to her and what the Lord did for her and through her that you didn't know about. You couldn't see it, but in the darkness, light was shining, because that's a very Advent-y theme as well. But then the second reason why we're going to study Ruth to get us to Jesus and Christmas is this, not just that light was shining in the darkness and what was going on really has a lot of parallels between the Christmas story, but here's the other thing, is that Ruth will end up being one of the great, 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 great grandmothers of Jesus. She's in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1. She's one of four women to appear in the genealogy. And so you can't read the story of Ruth without getting to Jesus' bloodline. So we get to Jesus by going through Ruth. So that's where we're going to look at her story. This woman who lived into the providence and the mystery of God, and beauty came out of it. And so we're going to read a chapter a week. This morning is Ruth chapter 1. And we're going to look at this, how this story begins, looking at what seems to be a wasteland of a storyline, and is there any hope in the wasteland for Ruth? So here we go. This is Ruth chapter 1, starting in verse 1, as we begin our Advent journey together of beholding and remembering the story of Jesus' first coming. So Ruth chapter 1, starting in verse 1, says this. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephratites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went to the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These two Moabite wives, the name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died. So the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. A lot happens in five verses. Verse 6, then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food, like the famine's over back in Bethlehem. So she set out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went out until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? And she said to them, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Okay, little recap. Coming out of the chaos of Judges, there's kind of nightmares everywhere. It's plane crashes everywhere. The people of God are spiraling out of control. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. They had no king. We come to this opening line, not only that tells you in the days when the judges ruled, so like, hey, while this darkness was going on, the Lord was actually writing a story of light and hope. We'll get to that. But also, what's really interesting that the narrator does to the reader, which is helpful, is Judges deals with some individuals, like the judges and some different people, but it's a national indictment of a book. It's talking about the land of Israel and what was going on in the country of Israel. And then we get to the very next book, and the narrator slows us down, and he goes, yeah, there's a lot going on in Israel, but I want to tell you about one man and his family. I want to slow the reader down and cause you to pay attention to the details, the providence, the menial, seemingly meaningless, everyday happenstance of one man and his family, and watch what I do with this one family. So it's slowing the reader down, and then we look at this man, and what's he doing? What's he doing with his family? Well, there's a famine in the land, and Bethlehem, where they're from, and somehow they had enough means to uproot from Bethlehem and leave. And they go to Moab because they want food there. They don't know if they're going to have any food in Bethlehem, so they leave. There's a little literary irony because they don't just leave Bethlehem and go to a different town. They leave Israel. They leave the country of Israel. And they go to Moab, which is an enemy, people who hate the Israelites. They fought many wars against the Moabites. They go to an enemy land. And the irony is this, is that Bethlehem is two Hebrew words to make up one word, Beth Lechem, which means house of bread. It's a bakery. Bethlehem was known for its fertile soil. It was rich with grain, and lots of food could be grown there. And so in the house of bread, in the bakery, there's a famine. and they leave the house of bread, they leave the bakery to go to a foreign land. So here's what Elimelech is saying in the first two lines of Ruth. Hey, Lord, I know you've promised to provide for us in the promised land. I know you've taken care of our forefathers here. I know you've promised to never leave us here, but there's no food right now and we're hungry. And I know it's the house of bread, but we don't really trust you to be the provider of bread. So we're going to pack up and leave. We will go and we will find what we need outside of the land of promise. We will go outside of the means of God providing for his people, and we will take care of ourselves in Moab. Thank you for being our God, but you've clearly forgotten about us now. So we're going to leave. They leave the house of bread to go feed themselves. On some level, their exodus from Bethlehem is evidence for Elimelech and his family of a discontented and distrustful heart towards the Lord. He has promised to be the God of these people and always provide for them, and yet they decide, I don't trust that, we're leaving. And when they get there to Moab, Elimelech and his family, life hits the fan. Or you could pick another word for something that hits fans sometimes. Life hits the fan. Elimelech dies. That was not planned on by Naomi. And then the two sons marry Moabite women, which was against God's law. Don't marry other people from other religions who worship different gods than me. Don't do this. They marry Moabite women with their own gods and their own laws, and they do that. They marry Orpah and Ruth, her two sons do. And then after 10 years, her sons die. And I was trying to come up with, Daryl and I were working on this sermon this week for his 10 a.m. service down the street, and I was like, what is a modern comparison for what Naomi's feeling in this moment? She has uprooted her family, moved to a different country where she doesn't speak the language or speak the culture. She doesn't know these people. And then her husband, who she thought would be there to take care of her and provide for her in a patriarchal society, he dies. Now I can lean on my sons. They will take care of me. They will provide for me. They will give me an inheritance. They will give me social protection. Now they die. The grief and the loss of Naomi, just on like a human level, is nearly incalculable. But the social, cultural, like generational pain and loss and suffering that she's experiencing is really tough to communicate to a modern audience. In this time, she's completely alone with no financial stability, no social protection, no inheritance. And you take all that together, here's what Naomi is now forced to look at, a life with no future. I'm in a land where I don't even speak the language, and I don't know any of these people. I have no family here. I have no one to fall back on. I have no one to take care of me. And now everybody that I know and love has died, and I don't know what I'm gonna do, and I don't even know where to go. The only comparison that Daryl and I can come up with is like, can you imagine if you moved your family to Morocco and then you woke up one morning and all of your family, everyone you went there with to start a new life, everyone died in a bus accident, and you woke up and you knew no one, you didn't know who to call, you didn't know what language to speak, and you didn't know how you were gonna get back home. Like that kind of, I got nothing to walk into. Naomi has hit the wall of life in a fallen world. And this pain and suffering she's experiencing is not, the Bible does not comment this way. It is not saying, hey, this was the Lord disciplining her, or this was the Lord rebuking her for leaving Israel, and like this is how he's showing her this was. She's not being punished for leaving. There's nothing of the sort according to the scriptures. This is just simply the collision of a woman's life and a family's life hitting the tidal wave of reality that you never would have picked for yourself. And she's drowning in it. She is utterly hopeless. And that comes out. She's like, if I had any hope of marrying a man, which I don't anymore, but even if I had a shred of hope, which I don't, she says that to Ruth. She has no hope. And hope always, 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 always has to do with the future. So if someone says, like Naomi does, that she is hopeless, here's what she's saying. I have no future I want to walk into. There's no future that I want to get my feet out of bed in the morning and walk in the next steps towards. Naomi cannot see a future that she wants to live in. This is the embodiment of despair and depression. And I'm not even talking about those of us in the room that may have been diagnosed with depression. That's real. This is like what everybody tastes at some point, which is, I don't know if I want to walk into the future that I can see because there's nothing in it that I want to walk into. You ever felt that way? I don't even know if I want to walk into the future that lies in front of me. The future I can see has nothing in it for me. I saw an interview recently with Simon Sinek, who's an author, thinker, writer guy. and he was being interviewed by Trevor Noah at some conference this summer. It was fascinating. It was kind of like an impromptu thing. They were like, hey, we got asked like 5 minutes ago to come up and have a conversation, and it was really fascinating. You can watch it on YouTube, which is a website. And Simon Sinek's talking about friendship and loneliness in the modern day and the epidemic of that, and really for men in particular. But one of the things, they go off on all these tangents, one of the things he's talking about that relates back to this loneliness is he says, I believe we've had a death of idealism, like in the world, certainly in the modern West. Idealism being like, hey, there's this ideal, like peace on earth, or something that like is worth working for, worth giving your life for, worth getting up and like extending my labor towards. If there's a death of idealism, here's what that actually, it creates like a death of a future that no one wants to walk into. And here's what that does personally for people. It kills creativity, culturally, which is true. But then he also says it creates a whole bunch of anxiety and loneliness. Because we just retreat inward. If the death of idealism has happened and there's no future worth working for or working on, then I don't even want to be around people. I'll just continue to turn in on myself and continue to be more and more alone with the death of idealism. That's what Naomi is experiencing. Her ideal future died with her sons and her husband. Like, I thought I was going to have this future. We got to maybe start life over in Moab. I don't really want to do that. But now we're here. We've got this promise. Oh, my husband's dead. Now my sons are getting married. Maybe that can do it. And now they're dead. I've got nothing. That's what Naomi's feeling. Utter hopelessness. And so what does the hopelessness that Naomi is feeling create in her? Or let me ask it personally. What does hopelessness have the possibility of creating in you? So she has this back and forth, this long conversation with her daughters-in-law, and they want to come with her, and she's like, no, stay back. You don't need to come with me. There's no point in you coming with me. She's trying to have a logical argument. If I got married tonight and got pregnant tonight, which is not going to happen, but even if I did, you're not going to wait around for me to have another son, maybe, that you can maybe marry one day. Like, go find your own ideal future. Mine's dead. You go find yours. So she's trying to talk them in to staying in Moab, her daughters-in-law. But listen to how she describes herself in this back and forth. Verse 12 and verse 13, listen to what she says. Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, which I don't, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, here it is, listen to this self-description, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. It is exceedingly bitter to me. At the end of the chapter, in verse 20, she gets back to Bethlehem, and the women of Bethlehem go, Naomi, you're back. What are you doing? She says, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, which is the Hebrew word for bitter. She names herself bitter. Bitterness. That's what pain and loss and dashed hopes can do to us. And here's how it can do that to us. I'm bitter because I believe in dealing with me, God should have done better. And he hasn't done better. And so now I'm bitter towards him and bitter towards other people. Let me ask you this self-reflective question. The pain and the loss and the dashed expectations of your life that you have, what do you think about the Lord's motives or heart towards you because of those things? And maybe you haven't spent a ton of time connecting those dots or thinking about that, but if you're honest, what narratives do you write about the Lord because of what you've lost or not gotten? Like, what do you think of him over the fact that you're still single and you wished a long time ago not to be? Or what do you think about the Lord's heart towards you ever since you didn't get the job you wanted, but you moved here for that job, or you worked really hard for that job and then you still didn't get it? Or what do you think about his motives towards you since he let you get sick and he hasn't healed you and you've still got this chronic disease? Or what do you think about him and what do you think he thinks about you since he let your mom die? Or the fact that you've begged him to get rid of your addiction and he hasn't. Do you have thoughts about the Lord, about his thoughts towards you? Have you written a story about him because of how he's dealt with you? And how easy of a jump is it? Like, how easy is this bridge to build for all of us? God is against me. She says that multiple times. God is against me, so I am so justified in being against him. He started it. Like, he is clearly, his hand is heavy upon me, so I have every right to be mad back at him. I have every right to be bitter. He did not treat me the way that I wish he would have treated me, so I am completely righteous in my bitterness towards him. God has forgotten about me, and he doesn't care about me. And if this God of yours even is real, I'm not even sure I believe he's real. If he's real, I'm not sure I want anything to do with a God who would treat me like that. We write stories and narratives about the Lord, and typically when we're using our feather pens and dipping them in the ink jar and then writing the narratives about the Lord, the thing that keeps the ink jar full for us to keep writing that story about the Lord is our pain and our loss and our dashed expectations. Dashed expectations. Life isn't going or feeling the way that I wanted it to or that I thought I deserved for it to go. Or maybe you're on the other side of that, like, pride train. Like, I think I deserve better from the Lord. Why is he not giving me? Or maybe you go to the shame side of that, which is, shame is pride's cloak, said William Blake. Then maybe you just go to, well, I know I'm such a train wreck. I know I'm such an awful person. I don't deserve for the Lord to have done any differently with me. I deserve for him to be. He's terrible and I deserve it. But whatever that place is, however you get to that place of dashed expectations, life isn't going the way that I wanted it to go right now. It's the place where your longing and your pining and your groaning hits the immovable wall of, like, reality. And I want it to be different, but reality isn't moving for me. And I long for different things, and I want deeper connection with my spouse, and I want my kids to be different than they are. And I've got a prodigal that hasn't come home yet, and I don't know why I keep doing the things I've been doing for the last 30 years, but I can't quit it. And I want things to be different, but reality is not moving. That place is maybe the quickest path to a bitter heart for us. But please also see this, and this, I hated having to realize this week in preparing this. When you study this story, here's what you come to realize. The pain and the loss for Naomi, her dashed expectations of how life she thought should be going, that suffering didn't merely create her narrative of the Lord. The suffering and the loss and the dashed expectations just amplified the narrative she had already written about him. They flee Bethlehem because they've already decided the Lord is not good and not faithful to them. You've forgotten about us. You said you'd provide for us. This is the promised land. This is supposed to be the house of bread with fertile soil, and now there's a famine. You must not care about us. You must have forgotten that you promised this stuff. You must have forgotten that we're your kids and you're supposed to never leave us and you're supposed to take care of us. I guess that's not who you are, God, so we're leaving. They had already written a narrative about the Lord and who he was. You're far from us. You're not faithful to us. And so now when she's in Moab and suffering hits, what does that suffering do to her? It just reconfirms the narrative she's already written about him. Here is the incriminating thing about suffering. Here's what's really hard to have to be honest with ourselves about when we experience pain and loss and dashed expectations in life. It's a double-edged sword, and it's this. Yes, suffering does cause us to write narratives about the Lord and his character and who he is and what he's like. And suffering reveals the narratives we've already written about him. It does both things. It's what we see going on in Naomi, who changes her name to Mara. I am bitter. I am mad. I am angry. I don't want this life. Lord, you have forgotten about me. You have only dealt bitterly with me. Lord, you're bitter towards me, so I am going to be bitter towards you. And what does the Lord do for her? How does the Lord respond to her narrative writing about him? How does he engage with this bitter woman in this hopeless place? So the daughters-in-law, one leaves, Orpah, who, factoid, is who Oprah was named after. Bet you didn't know that. Mom misspelled it on the birth certificate. True story. Wasn't in my commentaries, but it was online. But that's who Oprah, they tried to name her after, her parents. Orpah here leaves. But Ruth decides to stay. And she's trying to talk Ruth into leaving too. You need to leave. Everyone else has left me. You leave too. Don't stay with me. And she's trying to talk Ruth into leaving her too. And look at this interaction in verses 15 through 18. And she, Naomi, said, "See, your sister-in-law, Orpah, she's gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you." And I love verse 18. "And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said, 'No more.'" That line often gets read at weddings, which is fine, even though it's not said in any kind of romantic or marital context. It's fine. It's fine. Because what Ruth just does embody for her is a lifelong commitment. But here's what's amazing. It's not just astounding that these words come out of Ruth's mouth, because Ruth is not an Israelite. But what Ruth just said to her is an embodiment, a full embodiment, as much as humanly possible, of God's love to his people. That paragraph that Ruth just said to Naomi is a description of the love of God. The Hebrew word that gets used to describe God's love more than any other Hebrew word in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word hesed, which appears more than 250 times in the Old Testament talking about the love of God to his people. Hesed love, hesed love, hesed love. It gets translated 30 different ways because it's such a dense word. But essentially, the shortest description of it, of hesed love, is what Ruth just said to Naomi. The love that Ruth just pledged to Naomi is the love that God has towards his people. And here's what makes this pledge of love, this declaration of commitment, here's what makes it so godlike for Ruth to say what she said to Naomi. The faithfulness and the goodness and the love that Ruth just pledged to Naomi has nothing to do with Naomi's response to it. "I'll go with you and I'll stay with you. And even if you don't believe me, it's not going to deter my commitment to you. Your faith in my words don't change my commitment and my faithfulness to you. I will stand with you, I will suffer with you, I will be with you, and I will not leave you until you die. I'll die with you. And you can't do anything, Naomi, to stop me from being committed to you." That's what makes it so godlike, is that the commitment level isn't based on the response. It's based on the committing one. And so in her grief, Naomi's, in her loss, in her dashed expectations, in her narrative writing about the Lord, in her bitterness towards him, here's what the Lord gives her. He gives her someone who won't leave her, to point her to the God who had never left her. Ruth is proof of God's love to Naomi. And so if Ruth is the embodiment of God's hesed love to Naomi, think about what the Lord is saying to Naomi in this moment, in her bitterness, in her narrative writing about who the Lord is and what he's like. "Naomi, my goodness to you, my love for you, does not originate or depend on you. You can write all the stories you want about me. It doesn't change who I am. My love for you does not get its steadfastness from you. My love for you is rooted in my character. And so my commitment to you will not stop coming towards you, because it never had anything to do with you or your performance or your faith or your response to me in the first place. You can't lose my goodness to you because you can't lose me." The Lord is confirming for Naomi that in the experience of life's pain and loss, it may often appear that God's silence equals his absence. And he's telling her, I know it seems like I'm far off. I know it seems like I've forgotten you, but I'm sending you, Ruth, to whisper something else to you. My silence does not equal my absence. It may seem like I'm not responding the way that you want me to. It may seem like I'm far off, but that doesn't mean I'm far from you. That doesn't mean I've stopped being faithful to you. Silence does not equal absence from the Lord. And if you pull that thread, like, that is the Lord. That is Hesed love, that his silence does not equal his absence. If you keep pulling that thread of his character about 1,000 years after Ruth, you'll get to a place in Israel's history where the Lord seemed very silent because he was. It's after Babylonian captivity, 70 years in Babylon. They come back home. They rebuild the temple. They rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And then there's a couple prophets, couple minor prophets that give the people of God some words from the Lord. Malachi is the last one. It's the end of the Old Testament. And then after Malachi closes his book, there is 400 years of silence from the Lord to his people. 400. These people who had heard from the Lord and he had dealt with them, and they knew his faithfulness, and they knew what kind of stories he wrote for them. There's 400 years, no revelation, no redemption, no prophets, no kings. It's crickets from the Lord. And so that, it's the intertestamental period, 400 years of silence. In that silence, imagine yourself being in Israel in those days. What were the people of God thinking about the Lord in that 400 years of silence? What do you think? Same thing Naomi was thinking. God has clearly forgotten about us. His silence is his absence. He is far from us. He is not faithful to us. His goodness has left us. And into that place, into that narrative that his people had written about him, into their bitterness, what did the Lord do for his people? Hesed love was sent again. An outsider came and showed up on the scene, born in a manger outside Bethlehem. And here's what Christmas, here's what the incarnation of Jesus is saying to you and proving to you. Here's the story that Christmas is writing. Here's what the arrival of Jesus in a manger says to you. Where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. And where you die, I will die. I will go with you and I will stay with you, and your response to me will not deter my commitment to you. I will stand with you, I will suffer with you, I will be with you, and I will not leave you. And just like Ruth, here, I love this description of her. When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she got real quiet. Jesus is determined to stay with you. Christmas is the proof that there is hope for you, no matter what your future holds. Because of this, you will not walk into your future alone. Even if you don't believe it, even if you reject it, even if you doubt it, even if you're unsure of it, even if you have a bitter storyline towards the Lord, you will not walk into your future without the goodness and the faithfulness of the Lord carrying you there, because his Hesed love is committed to you. Hesed love is your hope even when the days seem dark and grief is great. So here's the invitation this Advent season, this Christmas season. Will you let the narrative you write about the Lord be the narrative that he has written about himself? Will you let Christmas be the story that says to you that he always comes to you in the dark because he never left you in the dark? Will you let Christmas be the reminder that when you have a future that you don't want to walk into and you have written bitter storylines about the Lord, would you believe him and let his Hesed love turn your bitterness into tenderness? You can't stare at the manger. You can't behold Christ in the flesh. You cannot hear this story and believe that the Lord is against you. You cannot behold it. You cannot sit in the Christmas story and then with integrity still believe the Lord has forgotten about me. Christmas is proof that Hesed love comes to you long before you come to him. Christmas is proof, just like Ruth here, that he is determined to be with you. He is coming to you. He has come to you, and he moved first. So nothing you could do, your response to him will not deter his commitment to you. So we're going to pray, and then we're going to sing, and then we're going to come to the table to believe it together. Jesus, oh my gosh, we have written so many stories about you. We write them about you without even thinking about it. We just believe. We're bitter towards you because we believe in our darkest moments that you're bitter towards us. You've forgotten about us. You're holding our sins against us. We deserve this, or we don't deserve this. We have all kinds of declarations about you and what you're like. And so instead of us writing the story about you, would you give us the faith? Would you give us the quiet? Would you still us to believe the story that you've written about you instead of the one that we think is true because of our experience? Would you let your story be the bigger and better narrative? Forgive us for our bitterness, Father. Would you cause our bitterness to turn into tenderness, we pray. Don't let us leave the manger until we've seen this hope in the dark. Guide us now in the next few moments as we come to your table in your name. Amen.